My name is David Plotz. I'm the editor of Slate. I'm glad that you guys have braved the daylight savings conundrum to get here. I'm sure there are probably like 600 other people who are just expected to be here but aren't here yet. I'm joined today by Evan Ratliff, who is the CEO, emperor, and editor of The Atavist. And we're going to talk about new long form, digital long form. And it's the shape of this presentation is a pentagon. No, the shape of this presentation is we're going to have, Evan's going to give a sort of quick history of long form in print and what it means now. I'm going to talk about what Slate has been doing with long form on the web, and then Evan's going to talk some more about what The Atavist is, and then we'll converse and dispute, and then we'll have questions. So that's what we're going to do. So, Evan, take it away.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. It seemed like a good idea when we decided that I would spend, quote, just a few minutes talking about the history of long form until I actually started looking into it. But I'm going to imagine that most people who bothered to get up at this hour probably are somewhat familiar with what we generally mean by long form. And I'm also not going to sort of start with, you know, movable type or papyrus or something like that in terms of the history of writing. But I think it's like, it's instructive to try to think about, it's a word that's now used a lot, you know, the death of long form and the revival of long form. And, you know, nobody really says exactly what it is. And I actually looked around for definitions, you know, what does this mean, long form or long form journalism? And actually, my conclusion was that it means almost nothing. So I made up this definition, which is things that are long. That's basically what people mean. Things that are longer than other things. And, you know, generally, I think people are talking about stories that are nonfiction that are, you know, of some length greater than 1,500 to 2,500 words. They may only mean things longer than 1,000 words. They may mean things longer than 10,000 words. But when journalists talk about long form, oftentimes they're referring to magazine stories, particularly kind of like harkening back to this golden age of magazines, whether it's the late 60s or the early 70s, where, you know, stories ran at 10,000 words and there are all these classic pieces and the advertising was there to support it. And I think people can mean, they can mean reported long form, they can mean essays. You could also be talking about profiles. And I think it's worth keeping in mind, just as we frame any discussion about this, that longer does not mean better by any stretch of the imagination. And yesterday, I don't know, probably a lot of you came to the curation panel, and Maria mentioned Frank Sinatra has a cold, which is, you know, if you talk about magazine journalism, that story would be mentioned inevitably as the greatest or among the greatest stories ever written. But it's also worth keeping in mind that that was a celebrity profile, which has since spawned, you know, decades of celebrity profiles that were probably about 100% too long. So these are the sort of, you know, magazine approach to sending a reporter out in the world, coming back with this in-depth story. And the other thing to remember is that the way that long form was largely paid for, is largely paid for, is through advertising. So this is an image from Janet Malcolm's famous piece, The Journalist and the Murderer. You'll see a very nice AT&T full-page advertisement. Actually, I was looking back at the story. It's full of full-page advertisements, double-page advertisements for Audi, for all sorts of things. So, you know, advertisers who paid for the privilege to exist alongside these stories and whatever readers they delivered. Now, so what has happened since then and what's happened in the internet age? Well, again, I'm not going to take you through the whole history of you know, page views and banner ads and click-throughs and the nature of advertising. In fact, I'm sure David knows a lot more about that than me. But, you know, the general idea is that here you had a medium in which there was infinite space to tell these stories. So you didn't have to balance them against the advertising that you necessarily sold in a magazine to generate X number of pages. And at the same time, the result were shorter and shorter and shorter in stories because of the need to get people to a page for just a few seconds or just a few minutes. And that in and of itself might not have had much impact on whether or not people did these stories digitally, but there was also a kind of conventional wisdom that developed around that connected to attention spans. And this is my favorite graph that I have ever seen in my life. In fact, I blew it up because it's so incredible. And this is from it's like a blog post from an advertising or branding company. And as you can see in this graph, our attention span is declining incredibly over time. The other thing you'll notice about this graph is there's absolutely no data associated with it. It starts with Dickens. Look at the massive decline between Dickens and Hemingway. Like, it's probably cars. Imagine the distraction of cars. And then you get TV spots and then YouTube. And actually, this is only from 2007. So just imagine how close we are to that zero line, to just, you know, like grunts and other things. Inability to communicate is basically where we're headed. You know, that became the conventional wisdom. Shorter is better. Shorter is the way that you capture people online. But not just that, but that the readers, they were not interested in that. Or maybe they didn't even have the capacity anymore to be reading long stories on a screen. And sometimes the conventional wisdom does, you know, it impacts reality. So, you know, the best example of this are newspapers also are purveyors of long-form journalism and remain so today. But the Wall Street Journal, Columbia Journalism Review, took a look at this last year, and the number, that's the decline in the number of A1 stories, and the Wall Street Journal had previously done, you know, these very rich A1 stories, and then if you look at ones longer than 2,500 words, it's precipitous. So, you know, that may be particular to the journal, and you can argue about whether or not that's good or bad, but certainly there was a move towards feeling like, well, you know, it's not worth telling these stories because people don't have time to read them. So, what happened since then? Well, I think this is more of what we'll get into, perhaps, but, you know, Twitter actually is something that started pushing back against this trend because you had things like Longreads, which now has 50,000 followers, in which people were pointing other people in their feed to long stories. And at least it sort of indicated that there was a demand to read these pieces online. Some of you may have seen Max from Longform yesterday. They're in the midst of this as well. So aside from the question about curation or creating this type of story, it's shown that there's a demand for this type of story, and there's a demand to read it not just in a magazine form but also digitally. And then two more things that have happened. One is that people are shifting their reading from sitting at their desk and reading at their desktop to reading on devices, which sort of return you to that magazine experience. You can take it wherever you want. And then the last is ebooks, and that, of course, is the other way that, you know, the very longest form has been paid for years, which is just the person who reads it buys it. And the amount of ebooks that are now sold, again, people who, what they want to do is read a long, you know, nonfiction or fiction book on a screen is sort of skyrocketing. And then finally, I mean, the interesting thing is that through all this sort of, you know, long form is dead, long form is coming back, something's going to save long form, these same magazines are still doing it, and they've been doing it the whole time. And in fact, you know, I don't have any data on this, but anecdotally, from what I can tell, there's actually, you know, been a movement towards longer stories in magazines. And you could see the logic for that, which is that in an age where the shorter things you are packaging into a magazine are more easily done for free because their opinion or they don't involve sending someone out in the world, that if you are pushing back towards stories that actually cost a little bit more money to produce and provide a more in-depth experience for the reader, then you're actually in a good spot. So the last thing I'll show is just I was hunting around for sort of these different elegies of long-form journalism, and I found this one, which I found to be sort of, you know, particularly poignant and sort of this genre of, you know, the decline of attention span, and an editor basically saying, you know, giving up the ghost on doing stories that are long enough for people to, you know, actually dig in, and they just don't have time anymore. And this is actually Lewis Lapham talking about Harper's in 1985. So it's worth remembering that this sort of, you know, up and down elegy of long-form journalism is something that also is part of its very brief history in journalism overall.
All right. I'm going to, if you'll bear with me, I want to start with a quick story. And like every story, it begins with sperm. And in particular, it begins with a sperm of Nobel Prize winners. And back in 2001, when I was a reporter for Slate, I set out to investigate one of the very weirdest and most audacious experiments in American medical history. It was something called the Nobel Prize Sperm Bank. And in 1980, a gazillionaire inventor in California named Robert Graham, there he is, had started this sperm bank, and he had planned to distribute this prize seed to women of Mensa with the hope of breeding a cadre of super children who would save America from the masses of genetic idiots and morons who dominate the country. And there was a huge flurry of attention when this bank launched in 1980, almost all of it negative. And then the thing disappeared. It dropped out of the public eye for almost 20 years. And in 2001, for a variety of reasons not worth getting into, I happened upon this story. And it was known that 200 kids had been born from this sperm bank. But Robert Graham was dead. The identities of the donors were unknown. The records of the bank were sealed. The identities of the children and the mothers were also unknown. And it was a perfect mystery. And it was, as a reporter, it was a black box, because there was no way to find the people involved in the story. But what I realized was that I couldn't find them, but they could find me. So I published a story in Slate outlining what little was known about this bank and invited people to contact me. I put my phone number and my email address at the bottom and invited them to get in touch with me. And I started to hear from donors, and I started to hear from I wrote about the donors who contacted me. I started to hear from mothers and the kids, and then I started to introduce the mothers and their kids to their donors and wrote about that. And it was a crowdsourced journalism 5 years before the term had even been coined. And each story kind of took me on a path to the next story. It was like I was the semen detective, and it just went on and on. And it led to 13 stories in Slate over the course of a few months, totaling about 20,000 words, and ultimately I wrote a book about it. This episode back in 2001 taught me that it wasn't just possible to do long-form journalism digitally and on the web in particular, but that in some ways it could be the perfect place to do it. It was a place where you could experiment and try things in a way that print, you could try certain things in print that you couldn't do on the web, but mostly the web was a place to do things in a very new and radical way. And so that was the promise back then, and I think now this promise has been fulfilled, thanks to some of what Evan was talking about, in particular to tablets, to the rise of curators like Max at Longform and Longreads, to Instapaper and other tools that make it very easy to read long things in a quick fashion. We are entering a golden age of digital long form. And for the past 3 years, Slate has been making a serious bet on this, where we have started something that we call, for esoteric reasons, the Fresca Projects within Slate. And every person on Slate's editorial staff must spend a month to 6 weeks every year working on a long-form project. The only rules are you are not allowed to do your regular job during this period, and you have to attempt to do something ambitious with the medium. We don't always succeed, but we can talk about that. So I wanted to spend my time today talking about what lessons we've learned from these projects about how to do long form in a digital age. And obviously, before, I should just say that there are tons of places, more and more every day, that are doing ambitious digital long form. Evan is obviously one grand champion of this, but plenty of places, including places that are associated with really short-form journalism. Huffington Post, for example, does long-form journalism in interesting ways. And I envy so many things that I see out there that many of perhaps you guys are editing or writing. So I'm just going to talk about what Slate is doing, because that's what I know best. First, I want to talk about kinds of journalism that you supposedly cannot do on the web, but that actually you can. So it's an article of faith that, the web is where you put the short stuff, the little bits, but that when you want something that is comprehensive, like the really comprehensive magisterial take on something, print gives it the gravity that matters. And I just think this is just false. Digital, because we have unlimited space, actually has this great way of making things comprehensive. If you want to be comprehensive about something, no better place to do it than digitally. So in 2010, Tim Noah, then a Slate senior editor, did a series called The Great Divergence about American inequality. It was a 10-part series, each part, 2,000 words long, about 10 different theories about why America was becoming more unequal. And it was an incredible piece of work. It won all kinds of prizes. He got a big book deal out of it. The book comes out next week, actually. And it was just an example of where having sort of, shit-kicking ambition to do something and to say, I'm going to go incredibly long on this, he was able to do it on the web in a way that, in fact, he probably couldn't have done it in print. I'm not sure anyone would have given him 20 or 25,000 words in the way that we were able to give him that much space. The second kind of piece that I think they say you can't do is a kind of piece that has traditionally been the province of Harper's or the New Yorker, the Atlantic, New York Review of Books, which is the idea-spawning essay. Something you read leisurely on the porch on Saturday afternoon, discuss over cocktails with concerned face that evening, and it really, made me really think. And it turns out, again, that I think this is an area where, thanks to largely to tablets, because you can now sprawl and read digitally, which you couldn't used to do, but now you can. There's now the chance to publish those kinds of essays as well. And I'll cite one example. In November, we published something called The Mouse Trap by Dan Engber. He's a neuroscientist on our staff. And it's a three-part essay about our terrifying reliance on mice for scientific experimentation and the fact that this reliance means that we're missing all kinds of drugs that don't work in mice but would work in humans. And similarly, we spend a lot of time investing in drugs that do work in mice but won't work in humans. And it's a $10 billion mistake. And scientists are only starting to realize it. Dan could have written a 750-word piece about this, which is the normal kind of thing that you do in Slate. But at 15,000 words, it had a kind of a majesty and intensity and importance. And it started a conversation about the subject. And we wouldn't have been able to do that at 1,000 words. A third kind of journalism that they say you can't do is investigative journalism. Again, we've had some good success. Emily Bazelon, one of our writers, decided to dive headlong into the case of Phoebe Prince. Some of you may remember her. She's a Massachusetts girl who committed suicide after being bullied. And Emily just thought there was something fishy about the whole story and spent a month really digging into this, getting secret grand jury transcripts leaked to her and speaking to witnesses that no one else had spoken to, and wrote a three-part narrative that ripped up the story that had been told in People magazine. And here was a story that was hugely ambitious and long and really confusing, and it wasn't even published on a tablet. It was just published on our website and in our pages, which are not the most attractive pages in the world. And it was our most read story of the year, just because people were willing to spend the time, because we had spent the time on it. Now let me turn quickly to kinds of things that you can only do digitally, I would say. One example of this is really gimmicky, but is real-time long-form journalism. So we've done a couple of projects like this. One, a writer of ours, Michael Agger, traded places with his wife, who was a stay-at-home mom. She stayed. He went home and took care of their kids. She came to Slate's office and did his job better than he did. And I didn't mean that. That was just a joke. And they tweeted each other about it. They blogged about it. They each sort of had a photo feed. And it wasn't no single piece in the series was long form. I mean, each thing was short. But when you kind of added it up, when you'd finished 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, whenever it was, you had this really grand project. So that's a that's a way where just the iterative and incremental things that you can do on the web can in fact add up into something bigger. Another form that we've experimented with is long form by social media. So Dahlia Lithwick, who is in her day job our Supreme Court reporter, decided to write a novel in real time, but basically by creating a Facebook community, and she ended up with several thousand people who wanted to be part of this, and getting these people on Facebook to tell her, okay, what am I going to name my characters? Okay, if I want to have a plot twist involving this particular kind of legal case, how would it happen? And the readers helped her write the story via Facebook. And ultimately, I mean, she even had a book party for this thing where they convened via Facebook and then met at some bar in Washington. Another example is adding elements to a traditional kind of story that can only work digitally. So Will Salatan wrote a long profile of a scientist some of you may know called Elizabeth Loftus. It was in most respects a very traditional kind of profile of the sort you would read in the New Yorker. Loftus is a memory scientist, and she's famous for debunking recovered memories and also for showing the way in which your memories of things that didn't happen can be implanted in you. And so it was a brilliant, you know, just piece of reporting, wonderful profile. But Will did something very weird and clever, which is that he had us publish an apparently unrelated Slate story, which was a slideshow which appeared to be a sort of photographic history of the decade. And in fact, this was a version of one of Loftus's own experiments, where intermingled with real events were photographs of events that had not happened, such as President Obama shaking hands with Ahmadinejad. But he was able to show, and he had people see the slideshow, and I've forgotten exactly the details, but sort of be quizzed on the slideshow. People who are readers saw this, and they then remembered this event happening. And we were able to show them that they had been subjects of the very experiments that Loftus had been doing, and we were able to sort of prove to them, hey, look, you, just as she has shown this, you know, in experimental research, we've just done this experiment on you. You've participated in it. And look at the evidence of it. One final example of this is, and we've not done this as well as I'd like, but incorporating games into long-form work. So a couple of years ago, our executive editor, Josh Levine, decided to do a project about how America would end. It was really apocalyptic and grim, and it was just about, you know, what will happen when we're all huddled and outside of Cleveland, around the Great Lakes, in small rural communities, fending off the zombies. But it was a great doomsday account. But what he included in it was something called Choose Your Own Apocalypse. And it was 144 different scenarios. And what he did is he just said, you tell us the five scenarios that you think are most likely to occur, and give us a little bit of information about yourself, where you live, male, female, you know, what your political leanings are. And we were able to do a little bit of data mining and to show, first of all, how Slate readers thought the world was like, America was likely to end, how conservatives versus liberals thought America was likely to end, which was really interesting, that liberals were obsessed with environmental degradation and conservatives were obsessed with sort of foreign threats, and the differences between men and women, similarly. And again, it was a real little enticement that got people to engage with what was a 8,000-word series of articles. 60,000 people played this game with us. So I think editors here are perhaps contemplating happily how wonderful some of this is, you know, giving their writers time and space to create lasting big work, build community around that, and avoid quick hits. Also, it's catnip for prizes. If you're prize winning, want prizes. This kind of work wins you more prizes than aggregation does. But probably publishers are snickering because all the superficial indications are that this investment in long form is a really bad investment of time and energy. A page view is a page view. A unique is a unique. I kind of sometimes when I'm feeling anxious, I run the mental numbers, and my best guess is, you know, one of these long-form projects that we do attracts several hundred thousand unique readers to Slate who spend a bit more time with us, and, you know, some multiple of that in page views. But that same writer deployed on their regular beat over that period of time would probably generate 4 or 5 times as much traffic for Slate, 4 or 5 times as much as many uniques for Slate. Moreover, insofar as we have any news, that we break any news in the work that we're doing, it is very quickly co-opted by aggregators. I mean, in the case of Emily Bazelon's story about Phoebe Prince, the Huffington Post, I strongly suspect, got more traffic off that story than we did. And, you know, that's obviously a bummer, but so it goes. And sort of one final thing which relates to Slate, although not to the atavist, is that we have not figured out a way to make these pages look as good and make them read as cleanly as we need to. This is that's a real project for us. So I think that the superficial business case is not there, but I want to finish with one final example, which is Julia Turner, who's actually here, who's our Slate's deputy editor, a couple of years ago did a series about American signs and why American signage is so bad. In particular, if you get a chance, watch her video about the signage in Penn Station. Anybody who's been to Penn Station, which is the worst sign place on the face of the earth. But Julia did this series. It was great. And we sold it to an advertiser for like a couple $100,000. It was 1 month's work by Julia. We got a couple $100,000 of ad revenue out of it. We don't sell all of these projects. We don't even sell most of them. But for certain kinds of advertisers in certain situations, being around long, attractive, ambitious work is great. That they can buy kind of network ads anywhere. They can get that for any site, you know. And we can't fund this work with network advertising revenue. But insofar as there are advertisers who want to be around some sense of community, some sense of cool, some sense of ambition, long form is really special and really distinguishes you from your competition. And as an editor, it's wonderful. I mean, it has the obvious benefits of, like, what editor wouldn't rather edit some really long, ambitious piece than another 600-word thing? But it is it creates a community of readers. That one of the anxieties that I have as a web editor all the time is that the world is filled with readers, but most of them aren't really Slate readers. They may hit Slate stories, but they don't feel a sense of identification with Slate. One thing that long-form projects do is really create a sense of, I am reading this at Slate. I'm here at Slate. I'm in the Slate community. And that's incredibly valuable for us, both morally and psychologically, and I hope financially. So let me turn it back to Evan, who really has found a way to make money on this.
So this is an image of our app. So I feel like there might be some people in the room who are very familiar with it and some people who aren't. So I won't spend a whole lot of time on it. But just to describe a little bit of what we do. So we're a small outfit. We're based in Brooklyn, New York. We launched a year ago. And we publish only long form, and you could call it the sort of longest long form. And we really set out with two goals, two areas that we were interested in sort of attacking from a journalistic perspective and from a publishing perspective, one of which was stories that are longer than most magazine stories but shorter than books, which is an area that doesn't work particularly well in print. You can always find examples of it, but if something wasn't long enough to push out as a $30, $25 hardback, and it was too long to fit into a 5,000-word, maybe 10,000 at most, word magazine story, it was sort of lost. So we were looking to create a place where those stories could be told. So that was one aspect. And then the second aspect was to try to figure out a way to, by being digital first, to design these long-form pieces specifically for reading on mobile devices. And that's what we tried to do in our app. And part of that is incorporating multimedia in ways that we hope actually, you know, enhance the way the story is read and the way the story is told. Now, we may or may not always succeed at that, but I think our goal is to try to preserve the story while at the same time, you know, pushing forward in experimentation. So I'll just show one piece, which is Our latest one, it's a story about an investigator from NASA. He's actually a former NASA investigator now who was completely obsessed with finding these moon rocks that were brought back from the moon and then distributed by Nixon to countries all over the world. Almost every country got one. All 50 states got one. And then over the subsequent decades, many of them lost them. Some of them were actually victims of theft and fire and all these things. And this NASA investigator was tasked with tracking them down, particularly as they were sold on the black market. So it's a really sort of fun yarn of his obsession with doing this. In fact, he's so obsessed that after he left NASA, he started teaching classes at the University of Phoenix that were supposed to be about, you know, basic investigation, and all he does is make his students track down moon rocks. That's basically their task when they show up, is he says, all right, everybody pick a moon rock, and by the end of the semester, hopefully we'll find it. So this piece is kind of an example of how we treat our stories differently in the different places that they're read. So if you read it in the app itself, it actually starts with footage from the moon landing, and the actual footage of the Goodwill moon rock, which is a particular rock, was split up into all these samples being picked up. I don't have the sound plugged in, so most people won't be able to hear it, but it's the actual sound of the astronauts selecting the sample, and they pick it up, they talk about it, and then they bring it back, and then after that, you're dropped into chapter one. Now, chapter one takes you to South America, where there's a general who, or he's actually a colonel, who has ended up with a moon rock after a coup, and he's trying to sell it to this fruit juice salesman from the U.S., and it sort of starts off from there. But the idea is that, you know, in the text-only version, we have the writer has written an account of the moon landing and the astronauts picking up the rock, and that's the chapter in the text version. And in this version, you're actually having a different experience because you're watching the video and then you're dropped into the text. So, you know, that's sort of one example of the type of thing we try to do. Now, each of our stories has a full audiobook read by the author usually, so you can flip back and forth between reading and listening. So again, it's a way to sort of try to take advantage of how these tablets work. Some of them have musical soundtracks. This one's actually, its musical soundtrack is a soundtrack of the sort of chatter from moon landings. And then we also try to kind of nest in a lot of other either interactive elements or just sort of helpful reader, the kind of things would be reader-driven if the reader was online. So the types of things that a reader might go look up or they might be more interested in, we try to layer those into the story. So if you hit a little button, some of the text raises up, and then different aspects of the story are available to you as these kind of extras, like the characters. So these stories are very long. This one's 15,000 words. So you put it down, you pick it back up, you can't remember a character, you tap on their name, and you get a bio. And then you can swipe through the characters and see who else is in the story. There are timelines in there so that for the same reason you might get lost in the story, you can pick up your place. And then we try to do various experimental pieces. So, you know, there may be, we have a story before this one, which was more of a memoir. You know, we had an interactive diary of this woman who grew up in this very difficult household and left home when she was 14. And then she, the only thing she took with her, never saw her mother again, the only thing she took with her was her diary when she was 7 years old. And we had that scanned, and it's actually, she's describing her childhood, and then you hit it, and then it's a flip book, and you actually flip through her actual diary. So the idea is not to sort of, you know, lard these things with everything we could possibly do, but to kind of protect the reading experience. So if you want a very sort of clean, simple reading experience, you get it, but there's also an ability to sort of dig in deeper. And as I said, the stories are actually told in all of these different mediums. So, you know, they're available on iBooks, they're available on Kindle, they're available on Nook, and we do different forms for each one, and we sell them for $2.99 in the app, we sell them for $1.99 in these other formats. And actually, I think I can potentially show it. I'm not sure if it'll work. But so this is, we're actually, we're about to launch a web viewer. So the stories will also be available on the web in a format that, as you can see, although it's not quite finished, is very similar to what you find in the app. And so our idea, just sort of in general, in terms of, you know, how do you pay for this type of story and how do you try to make money on it, or at least, you know, break even on it, is that we're asking the readers to fund the story. So in the traditional way of books, we're saying we're going to create something that we think is amazing enough that it's worth $2 or $3 of your money. We don't sell advertising. And then we split the revenues with the author. So we pay the author a fee that is usually in the thousands of dollars, and then we split them. We split 50-50, usually the back end of those sales that we get after each platform takes their 30% blood from us. So that's how we operate, and then maybe we can just kind of proceed from there.
So one question I had for you, Evan, is insofar as the atavist is successful, what implications does it have for A, the book publishing industry, and B, magazines? If you disaggregate magazines, will magazines stop commissioning work like this because these stories are going to end up just being standalones, or are they going to continue?
Well, I think, I mean, on the magazine front, I don't really think of it like disaggregating the magazine. I actually think of it like we're a magazine in which the feature well has swallowed the rest of the magazine. So there's only one feature per issue. In fact, I mean, in our app, we are a magazine. If you look at any of the stories and you open them up, you'll see, you know, issue 10, issue 11, you know, each issue is a single story. So, but to your question, I think, you know, magazines are also looking for additional ways to, you know, monetize this type of thing. So you've seen, since we launched now, you know, Vanity Fair and GQ will sell longer versions of their stories through things like Kindle Singles or just on Kindle. So to me, you know, I don't really get on board, probably because it's how I've made my living for most of my career. I don't really get on board with the sort of disappearance of magazines. You know, I feel like the experience of reading a print magazine is in of itself a very unique thing, and editors' sensibility in compiling that. And it's not just about the long stories. It's about a sort of what you get from the entire package of that magazine. So I don't really, I don't think that this and that are somehow mutually exclusive. I think that if anything, when we first, we went to a lot of magazines and said, hey, you should sell your long stories. We had this idea that we would sell longer versions of their stories. And they all kind of like patted us on the head and said, well, good luck with that. And now they're doing it. So I feel like it's just an additional way for something to happen. And then books is maybe a different issue, because with books, we're on the flip side of the amazing attention span curve, where we can say, well, we're sold alongside these books, but everyone's attention span has just collapsed. So don't you want to read a shorter, cheaper book instead of that long, probably too long?
I'm just going to grunt instead. I mean, the title of this panel is 140 characters versus 14,000 words, and Evan and I were talking a little bit about this last night. But it seems to me that one mistake, and Evan hit on this a little bit already, is to think of social media or of Twitter and shortness in the social media realm as being the enemy of longness. And actually, I actually have a different theory, which is that the rise of social media, and in particular of Twitter, actually is incredibly good for long form. And what it's going to drive out is a lot of the kind of commodity aggregation and commodity news reporting. Because if you can pick up the essence of news from some very, very quick thing in Twitter, and why does some aggregator then have to go to the trouble of writing 400 words about it? I think it's actually going to take pressure off of people to do that kind of silly aggregation, and maybe this frees up resources for people to spend more on more ambitious journalism. If people can collect their commodity news very quickly from social media, maybe journalism can invest in more ambitious work, such as a long form stuff that we're doing.
Yeah, or I mean, also from a reader's perspective, I mean, this again is very particular to me and anecdotal, but the thing that I don't read since the launch of Twitter are link blogs. I mean, they're like two link blogs that I read anymore, because Twitter provides that for me. So it actually, for me, has freed up a lot of time where I'm not sorting through, you know, 25 blogs that are sort of like, here's something interesting. And instead I get that on Twitter, and I actually have more time to actually read the things that people link to and say, hey, this is great, go read it. So for me, I feel like there's a fight back that Twitter is actually very valuable in assisting you in saving time, sorting through the sort of me too, here's another reference to something, or here's another take on news that happened 10 minutes ago kind of thing.
I just was on a National Magazine Award judging panel where I had to look at a lot of magazine tablet apps. And one thing that struck me, and struck me as you're showing the atavist stuff, is that magazines, and I still think are into, we're going to throw a whole bunch of crap up into our app, we're going to make it spin, and you're going to be able to produce widgets from it, and it's going to, you know, it's going to do all kinds of magic tricks for you. And what I think is amazing about what you're doing here is that the simplicity of the experience, you can have an incredibly simple experience as a reader of Atavist, or you can have a much deeper, complicated experience. But you give readers that choice, and you've created an interface which is incredibly elegant for that, and you haven't dressed it up with all kinds of stupid crap that nobody really, really wants and just distracts you. And I wonder if you have any lessons, because Slate has had a terrible, the thing that we don't do well at all, and Max Linsky was berating me about this over breakfast today, is we do not make our long stories look good. They don't look as good as the work in them. And I wonder if you have advice for us or for everybody else about how to make things look good.
Well, this is going to seem like a setup, but this is probably the best opportunity for me to point out that we have a platform that we license to other publishers
that
allows them
setup.
To do what we do. We do it. I mean, in truth, though, we do it because we're, you know, whether or not you agree with that assessment, which is very kind about, you know, our design, the wonderful thing about publishing into an app is that you can control the reading experience. So, you know, you can make choices that, and it's true on the web, and we just don't publish on the web right now, but, and without advertising, and David Carr actually, you know, sort of got to this yesterday, without advertising, you can design a very elegant experience. And from the beginning, our idea was that, you know, to sort of protect the text. And text is sort of primary for us, although we are doing we're doing a graphic novel, we're doing some more visual things coming up, but that the idea was give the reader the option to turn it all off, because the worst aspect of reading online is clutter. And so if you start with clutter, you're sort of, you know, you're losing the advantage you have in kind of trying to rethink how these things are told. And then the other advantage you have is just that it's in people's hands. So, you know, to me, not everyone loves the sort of tap on a character or tap on a place and get a map. But the people who love it really, really love it. And it's just a different experience than doing it on a computer and moving your mouse and clicking. It just feels different. And that's why when people make comparisons to CD-ROMs, that's always people say, well, isn't this just like the CD-ROM era? But it's just a completely different experience to be sitting on your couch and, you know, be digging into a story than it is to be sitting at a, you know, 1995 computer and popping in a CD-ROM and, you know, following, you know, hyperlinked novels or whatever it was. So, I think that design, we tried to make design, you know, equal with our pursuit of whatever stories we want to do.
I mean, this advertising question is really tough, because obviously for a place like Slate and for probably places that a lot of you guys work, we need the advertising. And not only do we need the advertising, we actually want the advertising. We want to try to find a way to create for our advertisers a really great environment and where they can, their ads can be as beautiful and elegant and showy as they need to be for them to reach their customers. And it's that tension between creating a simple reading experience and getting the advertisers the kind of experience they need is really hard. And I'm if anyone has a great answer for that and like has designed a great solution for it, please see me and tell me and give it to me secretly.
Well, I actually have a question for you, and then maybe we can open up for other questions. But how do you look at the cost of, you know, you said people set aside time, and if you look at something like where they have to actually go somewhere, you know, how do you budget for that? Our solution to that is we pay the writer a kind of bulk fee, and we say, you figure it out. Do whatever you have to do to deliver the story, and go pay your own expenses. And how do you approach that? Because these stories, if you're, you know, the moment you send someone to Wichita for a week, you know, your story's in, it's getting into thousands of dollars
that
it's going to cost you.
And in our case, so everyone who's doing this is a staff person. So these are already, so in some sense, like most of the cost is already built into our editorial budget. It's, you know, if Julia Turner takes a month off from her job, her salary is already paid for. It's already incorporated into my budget. So I only think I have to think about sort of the cost to the organization. And what we made is a decision. We made the decision that we have at Slate enough spare capacity that one or two people on our staff can be out at any given time, and other people are covering for them. So every one of the things that we do is that if our sports editor is out, our business editor is probably covering sports during that time. If our one of our politics writers is out, another politics writer is covering and making sure we're not missing things during that period. So we decided we have enough spare capacity that we can let people go, and we'll fill to cover it. But it exacts a cost on the organization, because things get missed. People they spend longer on the stories. When you're on salary getting paid to do something, it's easier for you to stretch it out, because if these guys are getting whatever you're paying them, $5,000, $6,000, $8,000, that goes only so far, and their incentive is heavily to get it done as quickly as possible. If you're on staff, your incentive is to stretch it out as long as possible, because the Washington Post company is still signing the checks over at Slate. So just keep working on your Fresca project. So it's a problem that we need to deal with. And I think it's like a cost benefit. The cost benefit analysis has basically been, this is tremendously expensive. If you look at the readership of these individual stories, some of them get a ton of readers, some of them don't get as many readers, but that the overall benefit to Slate as a brand is significant, and that there is potentially a huge amount of advertising benefit if we can figure out better and better ways to do it. But I wish I think the your model, again, where you have freelance writers, that they really need to get this stuff done, and so it works out.
You'd be surprised how they often still don't get it done.
So let's open up to questions. There's a mic here, and there may be a handheld. I'm not sure if there's a handheld, but if you would like to identify yourself, please do. And we have about 15 minutes for questions.
Hi, I'm Daniel Villarreal with the Dallas Voice. Quick question. I'm mostly a freelancer, and so often I want to do longer pieces, but the publications I work for will be like, hey, you're getting $150. You have a week. Or even less. It'll be like $150, you have 3 days. And I'm just kind of like, I would love to pitch you a long story, but at least in LGBT media, I feel like there's no interest. There's just not an interest. They won't buy it. And then it also seems that other publications I would like to do long form journalism for, like, we have a staff for that. Thanks. So I'm wondering, what's a guy to do?
Well, we each have different answers for that. I think in my case, our Fresca projects are staff projects, but we certainly publish long work by outside writers. One of my favorite projects we did this year was by Paul Lucas, who's a freelance writer, and he did an amazing kind of archival project for us. It's the money for, in our case, is not, you still won't, I can't imagine that the amount of time you would have to spend on an ambitious project would pay off directly in your bottom line. I think people who do that kind of long work freelance for us don't. The benefits are maybe they get a book deal out of it, maybe it puts their name higher profile somewhere, but the direct revenue benefits are not there. But I think with Evan, maybe they are.
Well, I mean the sort of thing that's said among freelancers of this type of work is to never sit down and calculate your hourly rate when a story is done. You know, you're paid by a word rate, but if you actually sit down and say, how long did I spend on the story, and then how much did I get paid, you're usually, you could have gone and gotten a minimum wage job and gotten paid the same thing. But I do think that, most writers that write for us are doing it, they're doing this type of work full time, and they're trying to do it for magazines. And I mean, we started this partly out of my frustration of 10 years of freelancing and pitching. There's only, you can count them almost on two hands, the number of magazines that will publish something of this length and pay you enough that you can actually do it. Because you really, it's very, very difficult to do a story where you want to spend a significant amount of time with a character or something if you don't have time to actually go, and you have to be doing other work. That said, people piece together, kind of an amazing freelance career. So to your actual question, I mean, what we try to do is get the writers pitch us. More than 90% of our stories are pitched to us, and we try to get them enough of a fee that they are paying their expenses and hopefully, with other work, putting things together so they can actually put the time in, and then and then we both try to get together and hope that it sells enough that they make their money back, whatever they lost. So, you know, I think there are more and more outlets for it, which is good news, and hopefully they'll pay better. But it's always been tough being, you know, unless it was 1968 and you were Gay Talese, it's always been tough being a long-form freelancer, I think.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Juan Muñoz from CNN. Could you explain a little bit about your editorial process to decide on the stories that you're going to do? Because, you know, you're going to spend time on a story, so you better be getting traffic or, you know, make money. So how is the editorial process to decide on the stories that you're going to do?
For us, it's we operate a lot like a magazine, a very small magazine. So, you know, we get pitched stories. We have a story meeting once a month or maybe a little bit less than that. We sit down with the 30 or 40 best pitches that we've gotten, and we just sort of hash it out. And for us, our sample size is so small in terms of how many we've done. We did 10 last year, so we're going to do probably 12 to 18 this year, that, you know, we're mostly going off our tastes and a sort of style of story that we want to do that's very heavily narrative, and it's maybe a little different than what we've done before. And, you know, so we're just trying to find this box for it that meets our tastes and doesn't sort of seem like we're doing the same thing over and over again. It's different probably for other organizations. I mean, we're a little bit almost more like a book publisher in that sense because we do so few.
In our case, every staff writer sort of gets perennially badgered by me to get me their ideas, and usually we'll run through, you know, 3, 4, 5, 10 before we settle on one that we think will work. And we're a little more Catholic about what we're looking for. Sometimes if someone brought me a great narrative story, I would be thrilled to run it. Most of the stuff we're doing is more essayistic or, you know, there's some stunt journalism in there and various sorts. So it's a collaborative process between our top editors and our staff.
But,
to come up with stuff.
But when you decide, are you thinking about potential traffic it's going to have, or it's just because you think it's a great story?
Mostly because we think it's a great story. We do editorial projects at Slate all the time where we think this is going to have a lot of great traffic, so we should do it. In the case of the Fresca projects, we're really trying to think this is going to be great journalism. And so we're very, very discriminating about making sure that people pick things that, one, they're incredibly enthusiastic about, and two, that we think will be ambitious. And sometimes they pick things, you know, we've done projects which have people have barely read, and yet they're brilliant projects. So we can live with that.
Thank you.
I think we have time for, I think, these questions and then, okay. And actually the last person.
I'm Amanda Petrie. I work in public broadcasting now, but I got a degree in literary nonfiction in grad school. And I'm curious about the production team that goes into producing a story like this. When I was in school, we always talked about this romantic editor and writer relationship, and you imagine Gay Talese with his whiskey and hanging out with his editor in a hotel room or something to get something like this produced. But now there's, I imagine, a much more collaborative effort that goes into the multimedia pieces of it.
We use robots to do everything. So we have a small editorial team. It's kind of like derived from what a magazine editorial team would look like. So we do work very closely with the writers in an editing process, a lot of back and forth. We do pretty heavy editing. And then we have fact checker who will come on board when it's in decent shape to take it off and make sure everything's right. We have copy editor who comes in. And then on the multimedia front, we have two full-time producers. And they will both go research and seek out media. So, you know, the moon landing video I showed, you know, they found that. It's public domain. It's free. They edit it together. They put the titles on it. They also edit the audiobook, so we have to get the person into a studio. So we have a sort of process that it's tacked on to, it lives on top of the normal magazine production process, where at the end we're kind of like layering in all of these other things. So we actually have full-time staffers who are responsible. That's their job.
I like the idea of romantic relationships. Writers, we're similar. I mean, in our case, it's our staff of our art staff and copy folks and producers who work with the writer and editor throughout the process to get it in shape.
Evan, I think it's really interesting what you're doing in terms of, it's not just long form, it's almost three-dimensional versus two-dimensional. And I'm curious, Have you guys, the stuff that you, the reader can, excuse me, the stuff that the reader can click on, the examples that you showed seem like added value. Have you, are any of the storytellers looking at the sort of three-dimensional sort of functionality of that as a way to advance the narrative or actually sort of revising the way that they're telling stories? It's like, you know, now I can go this way versus that way.
That's a good question. I mean, we have had that, but it's at a very simple level, almost the level that I was describing before. So one of the first pieces we did, one that I wrote, we actually replaced a chapter. We had a chapter, it was about a heist in Sweden, and one chapter was like surveillance video from the actual heist. And that was something that when I thought about how I was writing the story, that was a very big part of how I conceived doing it. We have a little bit of a disadvantage on that front because we are also producing text chapters, full text versions, so that means you got to go write a version of that for the other one. But increasingly, we now have writers pitching us, as you say, stories where they say, I can see how this will work on this platform. Maybe not as ambitious as multiple narratives and different ways into the narrative. That's something that I'm interested in, and I've thought about these sort of, you know, choose your own adventure kind of things. But with nonfiction, that sort of thing is very, very difficult to do without it seeming incredibly gimmicky. So if we found the right thing, we'd probably do it. But right now, it's maybe at a level more of how does video or how does audio sort of fit into the story I'm already trying to tell.
Cool. Thanks.
And this will be our last question.
Hi, my name is Sarah Scharf. I'm an editor for a tech think tank in San Francisco. I think one of the great things about kind of publishing on a digital medium now is that there's so many opportunities to kind of set up these poll platforms in advance to get feedback from readers and, you know, get insight into what people are actually looking to read. I'm thinking of kind of some of the successful Kickstarter projects I've seen recently with long-form journalism. And I was wondering how you guys thought that might change the face of long-form journalism, you know, be it the funding models or actually what gets put out there.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think as an editor, one thing I try not to, this is slightly different, I'm answering a slightly different question than the one you asked, sorry. But as an editor, I think it's there's a lot of editorial judgment, and I don't want to be too craven about doing things that our readers want, that so much of what makes a successful magazine or a successful story is giving readers what they don't know that they want. And so there's some certainly benefit you can get from surveying readers and finding out what they think of things, but often what they think they want and what they actually like are two different things. And also, it's a lot of the time the case that there's a small subset of readers who really want something. And it may be a small number relative to your whole audience, but if that small number of people is really enthusiastic, I mean, the story I mentioned, the mouse story about the scientific research on mice, very, very specialized audience, really, for that story. It was a wonderfully written story. It's beautifully done. But ultimately, the set of people who we want to read it is in numbers in the few thousands. And if it reaches every one of those people and none of the other Slate readers care about it, that would still be a real success for me.
And I would say that I really think that it's fascinating what's happening with Kickstarter and with raising money around these projects. And we had looked at using Kickstarter at an earlier point. Our hesitation was just around, I didn't want to do something general on Kickstarter, so I didn't want to say, hey, we're going to make a magazine, so give us money, because I was afraid that our magazine would suck, and then everyone would be disappointed. So we thought, well, let's make the magazine and then try to convince people that they should go read it because it's so great. But I think, you know, especially for us around specific projects, if a writer were to go say, hey, I've got an assignment from the Atavist, but they only gave me, you know, $5,000, so I'm not going to be able to go to wherever I need to go to do it, then I want to raise money to do it. I think that would be fantastic. I mean, it does create this different relationship with the potential readers because they're having an influence on, in some way, on the story. But I don't think that's necessarily a negative thing. I mean, it also creates an audience for that story when it comes out. So I think that's the beginning. It's just the beginning of what's going to happen with those sorts of things. We may not pursue it extensively, but you'll see, you know, dozens and dozens of projects this year, I imagine.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Thanks,
if you have great stories, pitch them to us, too, please.